The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's the Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We have a lot to share with you. People are stealing a lot of food in California, more than ever before, but not in ways you might expect. I'll give you the latest on farm thieves targeting grapes and even bees. And also America conned, psychopharmacic drug pushing empire under fire. Going to be a little commentary on that from Monica Young, Natural News. The latest on health and healing, alternative medicine. And finally, setting to rest the idea that somehow we shouldn't be having a single-payer coverage like Canada or Great Britain because look at the disasters of their healthcare system. Really? What disasters? You'll have a chance to see the myth that has been put forth by those who don't want a single-payer and the reality. So I'll share that with you. My guest coming up a little early in today's program will be Frank Schaefer. I've invited him to return for a longer interview to look at the dangers of literal biblical theology, particularly those that advocate human rights violations and the growing dangers of the Christian right in light of Norway. Last evening, I was in flight and was not able to watch it, but I had several people contact me by email and tell me, did you see Bill O'Reilly last night? He was defending the idea that this killer in Norway was not a Christian on any level, and yet the person who had on from the Washington Post showed that the man avowed himself to be a Christian and was basing his jihadist Christian attacks on biblical writings. Anyhow, I'll deal with that in the interview and what happens when people are in denial of what is possible or what has actually happened in the name of God. So we have a lot to share. Let's begin. First up, is America truly stricken with widespread mental illness? Do tens of millions need mind-altering drugs? And a recent flurry of media articles lead people to realize that big pharma in the mental health industry have decided Americans on a grand scale should be deceived, manipulated. You should create new diseases that do not, in fact, exist in reality. And then make sure that the control you have over government agencies like the National Institute of Mental Health and legislators or members of the administration like Hillary Clinton are there to propose, thank goodness that we have these laws because now we'll make sure that no one is left behind. Everyone who may be hiding some mental illness, it'll now be diagnosed so they can be helped, medicated, and we can be protected. Oh, you mean there's going to be a we versus them? No, it's going to be all of us will be medicated. The New York Review of Books, in a two-part article by Dr. Marcia Angel, senior lecturer at Harvard Medical School and a former editor-in-chief of the New England Journal of Medicine, summarizes it extremely well. She says, by analyzing three books by authors Irving Kirsch, Robert Whitaker, and Daniel Carlatt, that each deconstructs the apparent mental illness epidemic and theory that mental disorders stem from brain chemical imbalances which can be corrected by drugs. Dr. Angel's review has sparked a host of other journalists to applaud her and fuel the fire. In fact, an article in Forbes even concludes, quote, psychopharmacy is looking like an idea whose time has passed. Let me just share an overview. Right now, at least 10% of Americans over the age of 6 take antidepressants. Antipsychotic drugs, once reserved for schizophrenics, have become the top-selling class of drugs in the United States with over $14 billion in sales in just 1 year. and ADHD and bipolar and autism diagnosis have exploded in the last two decades, with at least 5 million more children now on psychiatric drugs. 10% of all the boys in the United States take drugs for ADHD. Even young children, over 500,000, take antipsychotics, including preschoolers, the youngest 6 months of age. How in the world could any reasonable physician say that a child at 6 months, a baby, has bipolar? Babies laugh, babies smile, babies cry, babies scream. Every baby in history has gone through some crying and smiling. Does that make everyone born with a genetic brain imbalance? Well, when you consider how many babies and infants and toddlers are being given psychiatric drugs, and the fact there is zero science justifying this, and yet these people are rewarded, they're paid by the insurance companies, then you realize how bad the situation is. Now, the chemical imbalance theory rose to fame when Prozac hit the market in 1987. And it was accompanied by massive hype that it corrected a chemical deficiency in the brain. And the years that followed, the number of people prescribed drugs for mental illness has just gone through the roof. Today, the official treatment for mental disorders is synonymous with psychoactive mind-altering drugs. Now, tracing the origin of this theory shows it wasn't that chemical imbalances were discovered in the mentally ill, and then drugs were devised to correct the imbalance. Instead, drugs created for other purposes were incidentally found to also affect brain chemicals and blunt mental symptoms. Drug companies, hungry for new markets, and psychiatry eager to build stature as a legitimate medical profession, which it is not, it's quackery, leapt on its feet and says yes. They conducted a vast campaign to popularize chemical imbalances that cause mental disturbances, which there's never been a single study to prove. Absolutely none. In fact, in a new documentary that I am producing on Return to the Snake Pits — snake pits is a term that used to be used for psychiatric institutions, except now I'm extending a building like Creedmoor that held people diagnosed with mental illness to virtually everyone's home in the United States. They now have the capacity to bring you drugs to your home to do the prescribing and see that you're treated by your physician, primary care physician, or psychologist, psychiatrist, under this drug protocol, so there's no need to formally institutionalize people unless they refuse to accept that they have a brain chemical imbalance because they like to keep a neat room, or they don't like hard partying with their friends, and hence social anxiety disorder or compulsive disorders would be their diagnosis. But if they oppose that, yes, you can be arrested, and they have been under Teen Screen, which is a completely fraudulent program put together by Big Pharma and promoted initially by Governor George Bush of Texas, and later promoted through Hillary Clinton and other corporate Democrat ideologues. Most scientific studies that you will find disprove the chemical imbalance theory. In fact, taking a hidden camera into 12 leading, very well-known and very well-respected psychiatrist offices and filming an undercover sting with a completely healthy woman who was given different diagnosis and given different medications in every single case, then confronted on the street later, this is a completely normal person. Well, you know, it's subjective, but you didn't say it was subjective in your office, and all completely legal. In fact, a psychiatrist could misdiagnose every single patient they see and still be rewarded. And then, standing outside the American Psychiatric Association's annual meeting and then interviewing the participants around the world, every single one: is there a chemical imbalance that you can measure to determine that a person is bipolar? No. Is there any test you can take, medical test, diagnostic test, to show that someone has a brain chemical imbalance? No. Is there anything objective that you can show in all of psychiatry to determine that a patient actually has physical symptoms? And the answer is no. Every one of them. They're saying no. then is purely subjective. Yes, purely subjective. But we wouldn't know that from the television commercials, would we? Now, this year, prominent neuroscientist Dr. Nancy Andreessen announced proof that antipsychotics shrink the brain. Oh, that's not good. No, it's not. And we also have absolute proof that antipsychotics do no better than a placebo pill, a sugar pill, at helping you with depression. That's not good either, because a sugar pill doesn't create desires to commit suicide. Antipsychotics do. Studies also demonstrate that long-term recovery rates are higher for non-medicated patients. For instance, the World Health Organization conducted an investigation in 15 cities around the world, and out of 740 depressed individuals studied, those who did not take any drugs, those who were not given psychiatric medications, had the best long-term outcomes. In the pre-medication era, it was known that with time and counseling and love, people usually recovered from depression. If kids had tantrums, were unruly or shy, they were apt to outgrow it. Today, individuals branded with disorders are likely to receive long-lasting diagnosis, endless prescriptions, and the poor ones tend to remain on disability for life. So Dr. Angel says that the author of each of the three books agrees on, quote, the disturbing extent to which the companies that sell psychoactive drugs through various forms of marketing, both legal and illegal, and what many people would describe as bribery, have come to determine what constitutes a mental illness and how the disorder should be diagnosed and treated, unquote. Well, according to IMS Health, an information and consulting company, pharmaceutical companies spent $6 billion last year marketing just to doctors. Another $4 billion, which made $10 billion direct-to-patient advertising. Drug trials used to bring a drug to market are funded by drug companies, heavily biased and misleading. Companies may sponsor as many drug trials as they like until they have just two positive ones to submit to the FDA. Great care is taken to hide negative trials. The highly positive results of placebo trials are downplayed. A high percentage of patients recover on a fake drug, like a sugar pill, proving that the more a person believes he will benefit from a treatment, the more likely he will to experience a benefit. In regards to this comic book, Diagnostic and Statistical Manual, the psychiatric Bible of mental disorders used to prescribing drugs, Dr. Angel points out, quote, in all of its editions, it has simply reflected the opinions of its writers, unquote, meaning there's nothing scientific about it. But it's an extremely dangerous book, because once they agree through purely subjective opinion that a behavior is a mental disorder, then the court system can hold a person legally accountable for manifesting that disorder. That's how much power this has. And yet this isn't being discussed anywhere in liberal or conservative radio, which is unfortunate. Now, I am not opposed to psychiatric medication being used, even heavily used, even intravenous 24 hours a day, providing it's only on politicians. Oh, and media moguls. Oh, and lawyers. And journalists. Yeah, those would be good to see them sitting around with Demerol at about 7 million milligrams a day going in. Wonder what they would write then afterwards about their experience, since they don't seem to believe that these are not legitimate. The entire field of journalism has accepted that we have an epidemic of bipolar, and therefore the treatments are necessary. The children are, for the first time in American history, developing mental chemical imbalances in the brain that we've never had before, but it's completely legitimate, and the treatment is absolutely necessary. None of these have gone after this and done an objective and fair job. I consider this a crime against humanity. And where has the mental health industry and the drug therapy brought our nation? As Americans line up at their local pharmacy, documented side effects are legion. weight gain, deadened emotions, diabetes, heart problems, liver damage, stunted growth in kids, shortened lifespans, and suicide. Those prescribed one psychoactive drug are commonly prescribed another to address the side effects of the first one, and so on. Then they end up with a whole cocktail of these deadly meds. Each year, more than 2.2 million Americans are hospitalized for adverse drug reactions. Over 100,000 die from them. So let's just put this in perspective. Instead of decreasing the number of adults on disability payments for mental illness, it has soared 250%, and in children, 3,500%. The greatest crime to humanity is the mass drugging of children. Yet it's perpetrated within schools and doctor's offices and foster homes and juvenile facilities every day. There is no good news in this. Yes, the evidence is overwhelming that we have been drugging adults and senior citizens and children who didn't need it and killing them 100,000 a year. But in America, hey, in 4 years, they killed 60,000 with one drug, Vioxx, and the man who ran the company got a raise. Shareholders got an increase in the value of their stock. 100,000 dead Americans from using these drugs. Not a single thing done about it. No meetings, no committees, no reform, no change. I'm Gary Noll. Your thoughts. That's our commentary at the beginning of our program. You have a chance to share your points of view now. Give us a call at 888-874-4888. 888-874-4888. We'll be going to my guest in approximately 10 minutes. I want to hear from you now. Back in a moment to take your calls and say hello to Elizabeth, who's in studio today with, because we didn't have a chance to get to her yesterday. We had such a packed show with a long commentary. And we'll see what you're writing in the mail. Please stay with us. Calls to come in. I'm just back. I'm going to take a day after the show today to run on the beach. Just got over Miami, landed. What a beautiful place. Sometimes I go there just to take long runs and relax my mind. You have no idea how much we've been filming, how much good stuff. I'm not talking about what I filmed because it's very controversial, very hard-hitting, but it's going to be very important. You'll see it shortly. Let's say hello to Gordon from Queens. Hi, Gordon. You're on the air.
Hi, Gary. Thank you for taking my call. I want you to know over the years I was able to glean the language from your show, and I mentioned several years ago that I confronted the forensic psychologist in my divorce case in Queens County, New York, and I told him that this is an impeachable offense, that you're going around telling my ex-wife that I've got a chemical brain imbalance, that you've made an unqualified medical determination, you're not a medical doctor, and there is no scientific data to back up your subjective opinion. And that I gleaned right from this TV show, I mean your radio show. And last month I got certified to be a guardian in the New York City court system for not only senior citizens incapacitated, but the largest segment of our society of stroke victims today are women 50 to 65 years of age on antidepressants. And I would also like to be a guardian for these kids that they're allegedly doing psychiatric and AIDS experimentation on children in orphanages in New York City. and I thank you for your language and your inspiration and motivating me to do something about this.
I appreciate that. Thank you, Gordon, for sharing that with us. Ken from Queens, your turn, Ken.
Yes, Gary. Hi, how are you?
Good.
I want to talk about the Norway killer. I want to make a distinction between a Christian and what I would call a pseudo-Christian. Why can't we use the proper language and make these distinctions instead of essentially putting Christians in the category of murderers?
That's a legitimate question, and we'll be asking that question of Frank Schaeffer, who was one of the most influential fundamentalist Christian leaders in American history. His father, Dr.
Francis Schaeffer.
Francis Schaeffer, very significant to the Christian movement, and I will address your question to him. I'm holding my own thoughts because I don't want to preempt what will be a discussion between he and I. But it's a legitimate question. I'll see that he has asked that.
Okay. Thank you.
I appreciate your call. Thank you. And let's say hello to Elizabeth in Studio New York City. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hello, Gary. We've been sent an email today of an article from Science Daily that says that researchers at the University of Missouri have found that people in their 20s, the emerging adults, are choosing stay-over relationships. That is, they spend about 2 to 3 nights together each week while they're maintaining the freedom to return to their own homes. The study shows that it's a growing trend amongst college-age couples where they can stay committed, but they just don't have to live together. Because as the researcher Tyler Jameson notes, when couples move in together, they get a couch, they've signed a lease, they've got a dog, it becomes very difficult to break up, but the stayover doesn't present those problems. It says that stayover relationships are content in their relationships as they are in a transition phase when they've left college and they don't need to make long-range plans. So they have the comfort. But the idea is that people are choosing more personal control over their own involvement and commitment in the relationship. And it would seem it's more, you know, less pressure and more honest for these young people that are, you know, in transition. What would you say to that? Do you think it's the future? Would you say that traditional marriage may become obsolete for a younger generation and the future?
No. What I do believe is that each generation must understand the rules that they are asked to abide by, moral rules, ethical rules, standard of living rules, and then more often than not, with rare exception, they fit into those rules. By the way, some of the very first feminists in America, the ones who broke free, were never given credit in history. Barbara Seaman and I, the great feminist, and I wrote a book together, 1,600-page book on Call for Women Only, which details almost 800 pages of it detailed the history of women who broke free of the molds, those who wanted to stay single, and how not just their family, but society as a whole viewed them as a threat. I think you have to look at this from several perspectives. One is philosophical. It was T.S. Eliot who said, what is actual only for one time and only for one place, which means that, okay, that was a truth we had yesterday. What is our truth today? And don't tell me yesterday's truth must be an eternal truth, because everything in life changes. So let us change our perception. Now, then it was Eric Hoffer, a man who I have an enormous amount of respect for, who said that every new adjustment is a crisis in self-esteem. So how is it that if you've been raised to believe that the most important thing in your life is your family, and you start your life early, generally in your teens when I was growing up, you dated someone, that was the person you married, you immediately had children, you got yourself a house, and you worked in the same job forever, and your whole life was predicated upon living within the values you were given. Now we come to today, and people are asking themselves, just by looking at their parents and grandparents and others in their society, do I want to follow this same pattern? Do I need to in order to have healthy relationships, be fulfilled as an individual? And one of the things that younger people today are wise enough to take into account is that you're not the same when you're in a relationship. Something has changed. The relationship then dictates the life. So shouldn't we, instead of saying, I am my relationship, make the relationship we have with someone a third entity, You, your life, your values. Me, my life, my values, and what we choose to share together. And here are the conditions. Otherwise, what happens is we don't remember our dreams, the things we thought we would do, until the relationship became the only thought that we could focus on. So are we allowed to expand our dreams? Who created our expectations? Have we outgrown the relationship? And if so, what happens to the relationship? And our social networks are only sanctuary if we're young. And I have to understand, all of our problems are learned problems, and every crisis distorts your perception. So when you are in, when you lack money, you want security. And where do you get security? From a job or a relationship. And a lot of people would be out of the relationships they're in today if they were more secure as individuals. But if you allow the insecurity in your life to control your life, then don't expect it to be meaningful or joyful. It won't. And then we create these artificial illusions that we should be happy because we have this relationship. And that relationship is supposed to go someplace. It's supposed to go to marriage. Why? Because that was necessary at a previous time and may have been the best course of action. Is that the best course of action today? Today, people are not wanting to cling to everything. There was a time when you had to cling to everything because that's we didn't have any other security system. If you didn't cling to your family and cling to each other, then you frequently couldn't survive. Today, people are far more autonomous, far more capable of supporting themselves, but then choosing to be in a relationship and have the relationship supply them with what they want, whether it's creativity or compassion or joy or a place to share energy. But they're not saying my only life is this relationship. And the only legitimacy of a relationship is when you're going to get married. I don't need to get married in order to enjoy the true intimacy. And so people today are more independent. They see the limitations of the existing model. And they don't want to end up committing themselves to something that will forever alter their life and the circumstances. They want more freedom to first express themselves and be who they are and follow their dreams. And more people today are following their dreams in spite of the economic reality that we're living in than ever before. And I think that is healthy. And yet there are people who decide that the most important thing in the world to them is the relationship and the marriage and the family. And that's good. We should have that freedom of choice. We should not be a culture that condemns a woman who wants to stay single because she is so dynamic. She does not want to constantly be either A, nursing a man who is insecure, or B, tolerating someone who has to, you know, revert back to living in their cave before they, you know, have a positive moment. Or, you know, they don't want, they see themselves as far more self-directed. And when you are in a marriage, you can't be just self-directed. The whole marriage has to go with you. You can't separate yourself, and you can't separate yourself from your partner. So a lot of people today see, my God, how many people do I see who are dysfunctional on different levels? Do I want to bring that dysfunction in? And also be honest with yourself. When I was growing up, you didn't have that opportunity to see the truth in someone. You didn't have, no woman was told, go out and maximize your sexual potential. No one was told, see what it is about men you like and what you don't like and what you want and what you don't want. All that was not acceptable. You had to take what you were given. And only afterwards did you have to adapt with the hope that you did got someone who could be good with you or not, or incompatible or not. And then you had to stay together for the kids or for society or mom and dad, whatever. Today people are at their best when they're trying to relate with another person. But what are they hiding? What don't we know about them? What are their deficiencies and limitations? Which ultimately, in a committed, fully committed relationship, will manifest. And then you say, I've got buyer's remorse. I didn't know that you were so insecure. I didn't know that you lied. I didn't know that you had this very manipulative streak in you. If I'd have known that, now today they're saying, if I find that out about you, it's goodbye. And if I don't, then that's good. So you have to look at today's generation and their needs and their way of relating from their perspective, not ours. Remember, we can only judge them through a very conditioned mindset that already has immediate reactions of yes and no to who they are, what they've done, and that is not fair to them. It's like friends with benefits. oh, how terrible. You know, the women are skanky whores and the guy are just mindless gigolos, and it's all so bad. As compared to what? As compared to being in a sexually non-fulfilling relationship, where men and women constantly, by survey, have to fantasize being with someone else in order to have any excitement. People at least are mature enough to accept that they want to have sexual fulfillment without the need for a permanent relationship or marriage. That, to me, is not a step backwards. Yet I could just see how all the religious fundamentalists who have tied themselves to, you don't have to have good sex, you don't have to have happy sex, you don't have to have any safe sex, you don't have to have any sex. As long as you're married and you have faith in your religion, let God be, you know, that which oversees all of your passion. And hence, once again, religion, the body politic, social morals, all of that impact us when we're in any relationship. So today's kids are at least hip enough and wise enough to say, hold on a second. In the 1960s, didn't your generation wake up one day and say, we're not going to support this war in Indonesia? And didn't you think that your moms and dads and aunts and uncles think that you were crazy for doing it? What's wrong with them? Were they on drugs? No, what about those of us who weren't on drugs but were against a war? Today the kids are not against the war, but they are for a different lifestyle. And I don't believe it's for us to judge them in that lifestyle unless we also have their mindset and see the failure of the family systems they've grown up in and don't want to replicate. For those who do, that's their right. I just hope that they take their time and look at everything, including what I call the limiting factor. I came up with a philosophical notion about 20 years ago, and that is that in everything you do in life, everything you do in life, there is no exception. Your limiting factor will determine the measure of your success. So it's not what we breed on. It's not how we are pushed, manipulated, or grow through that where we succeed. It's what we left behind that we didn't address. All those little problems that we didn't think were important, that becomes a limitation. Let me just give you an example. Hi, Bob, you did really good last week. You sold $4,000 worth of furniture. Yeah, I know. That's who I am. But, Bob, you stole $5,000 worth of furniture out the back door. Well, I know, but I still sold. I'm your best salesperson. But, Bob, we don't want a thief who also is a good salesperson. It's the limiting factor that destroys us in the end. And if you doubt me, look at the politicians, look at the corporate leaders, look at the people whose decisions not based upon the best that they can come to, but the worst that they were. Their unresolved issues end up undermining their legacies and what they built. And it's also true for governments as well as corporations, as well as individuals, as well as relationships. So if you're afraid of finding and examining honestly and openly the weakness within your belief system, then don't be surprised when that weakness in the belief system ends up undermining your entire belief system. And I believe that today's youth are far and away more open about these issues than any generation that preceded them. And by the way, you know I'm from West Virginia.
Yes.
And there were two West Virginians, true story, walking down different ends of a street toward each other, and one is carrying a sack, and when they meet, one says, hey, Tommy, Ray, what you got in the bag? Just some chickens. Well, if I guess how many there are, can I have one? I'll give you both of them. Okay, you got five.
I'm sure a lot of people in the audience like that.
Two senior ladies met for the first time since graduating from high school. One asked the other, you were always so organized in school. Did you manage to live well in a planned life? Oh, yes, her friend said. My first marriage was to a millionaire. My second marriage was to an actor. My third marriage was to a preacher. And now I'm married to an undertaker. And her friend asked, what do all those marriages have in common? Well, one for the money, two for the show, three to get ready, and four to go. Two elderly women were eating, yes. Two elderly women were eating breakfast in a restaurant one morning. Ethel noticed something funny about Mabel's ear and said, Mabel, did you know you've got a suppository in your left ear? Mabel, I have? A suppository? She pulled it out and stared at it. And then she said, Ethel, I'm glad you saw this thing. Now I know where my hearing aid is.
Oh, no. What a visual.
Thank you. Let's say hello to my guest. Coming up in a moment. Please stay with us. I'd like to welcome all of you. I'm Gary Nall. Frank Schaeffer is a Reformed fundamentalist Christian leader who, with his renowned father, Dr. Francis Schaeffer, was instrumental in launching the Christian rights anti-abortionist movement into the public arena. And growing up, Frank was fully immersed in the upbringing and biblical doctrine atmosphere of evangelicism, having befriended many of the most famous evangelical and Reconstructionist Christian leaders before departing from the faith upon realizing the Christian rights theology and morality rooted in what he calls corruption and insanity. He has since been a Hollywood film director, a screenwriter, and the author of 20 books, fiction and nonfiction, much of which deals with growing up in a prominent evangelical family and critiquing the theologies and politics of the Christian rights movement in America. His most recent book is Sex, Mom, and God, How the Bible's Strange Take on Sex Led to Crazy Politics and How I Learned to Love Women Anyway. Nice to have you back with us, Frank.
Hey, it's good to be back. And, you know, I was listening in on the show before our segment here, and it's a good segue because, obviously, you know, the political comes from the personal, and the way you're raised and strange ideas about sex, whether they're biblical or otherwise, reflect on what happens in politics later. And if you look at the whole culture war that came out of the 1960s and 70s and 80s that my family was so much part of, and somebody really said, just give me one word with its roots to, you know, would it be economy or would it be politics? Really, the word is sex, because it's the view of sexuality which drove so many people on the religious right over, around the bend, whether it was their reaction to the pill or abortion or gay rights or women's rights or whatever it may be. You know, and you look at today's Republican majority in Congress and why they're not ready to do business with Barack Obama or Democrats or anybody else, so much roots back to their reaction to the sexual revolution that came out of the 60s. So I think that the Sex, Mom, and God, this book, is you know, strangely relevant for this time because, once again, you know, our whole national politics is being driven by people who just cannot deal with modernity.
I think that's a very insightful comment. I'm going to begin by asking you a question that was asked by one of our listeners earlier in the show. And his comment was, this person in Norway who claims to be a Christian, committed these barbaric acts and murdered all these people. And last evening on Bill O'Reilly, O'Reilly was really angry at anyone thinking this man was a Christian. He was not a Christian. He's never been a Christian. And yet he had on the reporter, I believe her name is Sally Quinn from the Washington Post, who said, but in this man's writings, he claimed that a lot of what he was doing was inspired based upon his Orthodox religious teachings. So I would like for you to address this following question, please.
First of all, as to Bill O'Reilly's comments, you know, where has he been for the last 10 years defending the majority of Muslims who are not terrorists and pointing out that it's completely unfair to lump 1 billion Muslims in with this tiny fraction of people who, in the name of Islam, have been committing atrocities. So first of all, fair is fair. And since the whole Islamic community has been blamed consistently by people like Bill O'Reilly and the religious right in the United States and around the world for the acts of a few people, there's no way to dismiss the acts of a Christian terrorist as those of a madman, and somehow when Muslims do it, oh yeah, this is part of their political or religious platform. That would be the first point. The second thing is, when you look at who this man was and the 1,500-page manifesto he wrote, you know, this was a calculated political act. He targeted the daughters and the sons of the Labor Party leadership who had gone to this camp for kids who were interested in politics, and it would have been exactly as if someone in this country targeted a camp for young people ages 11 to 19 run by an association that was part of the Democratic Party, who then launched a manifesto saying that he was against immigration, multiculturalism, diversity, women's rights, and all the rest of it, you know, then claimed that he was a Christian and then put pictures all over his manifesto of a big red Knights of Malta crusader cross. So, you know, there's no way to duck this. Now, obviously, you don't go blame any individual he happened to quote in his manifesto and say, oh, see, he quoted you, so it's your fault. But you have to take into account the general atmosphere we're living in, which is a time of polarization where extremists, whether they be Muslim, Christian, or otherwise, are essentially driving us all over a cliff. And those extremists are even in our own Congress, who, in the name of Christianity, people like Michelle Bachmann, are refusing to raise the debt limit based on some idea of religious and philosophical principle that they're sticking to against all argument. It's faith-based politics, not fact-based politics. And so I think where O'Reilly and these other people have to be corrected is in pretending that the general atmosphere set by people like Fox News, Rupert Murdoch, Sarah Palin, Michelle Bachmann, and so forth, doesn't contribute to a climate in which this sort of thing becomes more possible. That doesn't say it's their fault specifically, but becomes more possible. And it's the same thing with this guy who drove his plane into an IRS building and killed someone, or the Houthi militia that were training to murder police officers in order to hasten the return of Christ. You can't dismiss the lunacy on the religious right and what it's produced, or the ultra-conservative right-wing of the Republican Party that's taken the party off, and just say all your talk about hate and exclusion and getting rid of immigrants and stopping other people coming in and no gay rights and no gay marriage, at a certain point this has an effect. And I think in this instance in Norway, it's going to be hard to duck, because he left behind a long, big, huge, well-thought-out 5-year project of writing a 1,500-page manifesto that's very, very specific about why he believed what he believed and what he was trying to do.
All right, let's take a look at some basics. One of the core beliefs of the right, Christian right, is that the Word of God is the Word that we see in the Bible. And even if they only took the word to be the Old Testament word, when you read this, which I have, and I have about 1,400 specific instances where the statements that are attributed to God or God's demands are by any measure unethical, immoral, and illegal.
Right.
From cannibalism to having multiple wives to owning slaves, and to bashing babies' heads against rocks, a human sacrifice. If someone offends their father or mother, says something profane, they can be taken out and stoned by the village. In other words, I have over 1,000 of these, so I have a basic question. If this is the Word of God, and these people believe that it is unchallengeable, and that is the supreme word, that supersedes any moral compass we're living by as a society, What then prevents these people at some point, if not individually, at least collectively, justifying wars against other people and not looking at the fact we've killed over 1 million people in Iraq, innocent civilians, I'm not talking about combatants, without any thought that they count or anyone else counts as long as they're somehow not following God's way, or we are determining that God's on our side, so therefore nothing we do is wrong if we're following the roots
right.
of the Bible. Your thoughts on this, please.
Well, you know, in Sex, Mom, and God, I make a big point early in the book of saying something that I hope people really listen to on this show, but also if they read my book, notice that I did. I said, look, in my mind, there's two questions here. One is, does God exist at all? Well, let's lay that aside for a minute and call ourselves agnostic on that. You know, I have my view, other people have their views. That's not the debate. But the second debate is the God portrayed in the Bible the God that's actually out there, if there is a creator somewhere or a force, he, they, it, you know, we, she, whatever you want to use as a description? And I think that's a question that isn't discussed often enough. And so what I do in the book is I use a literary device. I have the God of the Bible, all in caps, hyphenated as one description, and I say, look, the God of the Bible is what we are discussing here, not God as he or she or it or they may exist as a force that's created. Because I think all too often, whether it's from the atheist side, people like Hitchens and Dawkins, or whether from a Christian fundamentalist side, the Pope or the bishops or fundamentalist evangelicals, the discussion is limited to God as if somehow we have already accepted that the God of the Bible is the creator. You know, I happen to believe in God. A lot of the time, I must admit, I'm an agnostic, and I have a lot of doubt about the existence of anything out there in terms of supernatural or otherwise. But, you know, when I do feel faith, it certainly is not in the God of the Bible. It is in the sense of love and reciprocity that I have in a relationship with my wife, playing with my two-year-old granddaughter, Lucy, the feel of her little arms around my neck, the look in her eyes. I see there a moral framework, a love that predates what I think is a cold mechanistic universe. Okay, that's just my opinion. I can't really argue it or prove it, but it certainly has nothing to do with this list of rules that, you know, women menstruating have to sit in a tent for 7 days, and if you touch them, you're unclean. If somebody loses their virginity, they're to be stoned. Slavery, all the other things you enumerated, and right up into the New Testament, too. You know, weird and crazy stuff about women keeping silent and all the rest of it. You know, so I think right at the outset, a big mistake people make discussing religion, pro or con, whether they're attacking it or defending it, is being limited to a discussion that is based on religious books and or religious teaching. You know, the civilization that produced these books is less than 10,000 years old. That's where literacy has existed. It's a geological eye blank. I mean, we hardly show up on the chart even as a species, and here we are making these big cosmological statements about the existence of God and what he wants and what he'll do to you if you don't do it, and we're in the infancy of our ethical and moral evolution. And so I think the two questions have to be separated, and one thing I do in Sex, Mom, and God is I separate them. I say, look, you know, when you're discussing ethics, you're discussing one thing. When you're discussing the God of the Bible, you're discussing a series of Bronze Age and Roman Age myths that a bunch of people took literally before the age of science, and now people who aren't thinking straight still take literally. These two questions have nothing to do with each other, and I just feel it's very useful to see that.
Let's take a little further. For our conversation, I'm hoping you can parlay back and forth between what we can know with a degree of certainty about the Bible and the New Testament and Jesus, which is the fundamental template for Christianity, and the Christianity
right.
we see practiced today. And while I always find
right.
history intriguing, unless it is brought into the context of our own time, it loses its significance for our listeners. And Christianity is the largest religion in the world if we include all of its many sects, and it has in the past and continues today to be an influential force in the shaping of our government and policies, even at the local community level. Yet from all the wonderful research that secular biblical scholars have performed, I'm thinking of Bart Ehrman at the University of North Carolina as one. We've had him on the show. We are faced with a dilemma of tantamount proportions. That is, the New Testament and many of the beliefs held in common by most Christians may all be based on fabrications and errors. For example,
right.
most real biblical scholars, the real biblical scholars working with the original ancient languages, are in agreement that many of the epistles of Paul are forgeries by other persons. And if this is the case, then can we accurately conclude there even existed a Christianity in the world today as Jesus may have wanted it? And are we forced with the possibility that modern Christianity is a complete fabrication and creation of the imaginations of people who imagine themselves as carriers of Jesus' original message, but only in their imaginations? Could you address this, please?
Well, it's certainly a possibility. And if you look at what happened to the history of Christianity and the barbarism that's come with so much of it, obviously a lot of it has been dominated by people who were seeking power over other people, which is no different than politics or family relationships or anything else. It just goes to show that religion is a mess because human beings have invented it. It's not that religion is a mess because there's something wrong inherently with all religion. It's simply that spirituality, like everything else, is captive to its human creators. When I paint an ethical picture that to live by actually gives you a happier life, I also look at a lot of the things in the New Testament purported to be said by Christ and or those who were around him, and I say, look, either these were later additions and fabrications, or they were just wrong at the time, and I don't respond to the teachings of Christ because they are in the Bible. I respond to certain passages in the Bible, either as poetry or literature or for ethical guidance, along with many other things, because they ring true to me in the present context. In other words, love your neighbor is something that works now, not because it's in the Bible or Jesus said it, but because I have, you know, been on this earth a few years as a 59-year-old, which is just an eye blink. But in that time, I've seen this principle work out more times than not. So I think, again, you know, when you come to something like the Scripture, I don't approach it as a holy book. I approach the Scripture as a fount of terrible things and a fount of some wisdom, something that Christianity has been based on, which I practice in the sense that liturgically I enjoy Eastern Orthodox liturgical ritual. But I in no sense look at it and say, you know, that this circular argument that evangelicals use, it's true because the Bible says it's true, it's just ridiculous. That's like me saying, you know, my new book, Sex, Mom, and God, is a great book because I say so in the book. Well, of course I say so in the book. I wrote it. And of course the church and theologians and people with an axe to grind will argue from the book, but it's entirely circular. If you have a scientific experiment, the scientists who do the experiment are not the people who then can control a double-blind test to see if it actually was true. They have a vested interest. And so, you know, arguing from the Bible to support the Bible is insane, and it's the only argument, actually, that religious people have. Muslims are the same. They argue from the book. But the problem is the book is what's in question, not because everyone is a cynic, but because the book also has so many things that are demonstrably false in it. But all the books, the Torah, the Bible, the Quran, all these holy books, have things in them that are so demonstrably false that obviously if we're going to argue about what's in them, the argument has to be carried on from outside the book. So if you take the teachings of Christ, for instance, you have to look at them in the context of ethical teachings that work and don't work, and say, okay, what will I try to follow and buy into? Not on the basis that it's in a, quote, holy book, there is no such thing, but on the basis of the fact that in relationships, in dealing with other human beings, in the way we want to be treated at airports, at check-in counters, how we would like cops who arrest us to treat us, how we will treat people if we go to war, whatever it may be, what works here? What produces a world worth living in where I feel safe and happy? That's the question.
Okay, that's a legitimate series of questions. What are your thoughts about belief in end times and the rapture and the emphasis placed on the doom and gloom images contained in the book of Revelations as rising to such high theological and evangelical status among Christian leaders and for shaping the kinds of belief we are witnessing today?
Well, you know, from my point of view, and I know this sounds harsh, but they're just absolutely deluded. This is insanity. And you can see the insanity playing out in some practical ways, and I'll just give you one example. You think of John Hagee's huge super church in Houston, Texas, 50,000 members, and he's a Christian Zionist preaching that Israel should throw the Palestinians out of the West Bank territories in Gaza, that they have a right to the land, that if need be, we should go to a war, a war with Iran, yet another war in the Middle East to make sure this happens. And so forth and so on. And it's based on his vision of the apocalyptic books of the Bible, not just Revelation, but other prophecies being literally true. He says they're going to happen. And somehow now it all depends on the state of Israel coming back and surviving. And so, you know, in his calculation, all of a sudden American foreign policy has to take the end times eschatology into account. And it's insane. But it's an insanity that's actually resonated with people like George W. Bush, who listened to the neoconservatives who made political arguments, but the reason he listened to them, and I knew the Bush family back in the day, is that he's a born-again Christian who shares that eschatology and figured that sometime, you know, somehow by declaring war on Iraq and weakening them because they were sworn enemies of Israel, nothing to do with these weapons of mass destruction, that's spurious and he knew it. He was looking for an excuse. He would use the excuse of 9/11 to hammer Iraq and strike a blow for the safety of Israel, not for political reasons, not because of what's good for America, not because they're allies, but because he believes in a Bible that teaches that somehow if we support Israel, in his view, you know, both we're going to be blessed by God, and secondly, this hastens the return of Christ. So you have insanity on a presidential level, and it actually happens. And you have people like Michelle Bachmann now running for presidential office who bring an even more extreme view and would be even more in that camp. And so, you know, these are not abstract themes. They've actually entered American politics.
My last question for you is the whole idea that Ann Coulter, Bill O'Reilly, Charles Savage, and others spew forth and rely on their so-called Christian moralism to support. I'd like you to address the perspective of the real Jesus, assuming for a moment, let's just for argument's sake say there was a real Jesus, that can discern from what is historically legit in the Bible. In other words, if the real historical Jesus were to comment on Ann Coulter saying that all liberals and progressives are godless. And
right.
If Jesus could sit in a broadcasting meeting room with Savage and others, what might he say? If Jesus were sitting in a corporate boardroom of Wall Street CEOs and even members of the administration's financial team, what might he say about giving to bail out the priests of free market capitalism system, the wild casino gamblers, such as derivatives and credit default swap, which have plunged
right.
our economy in income, and yet allow 10,000 foreclosures in 1 week. So could you address this, please?
Well, let's assume there is a historical Jesus, and I happen to think there is. I could be wrong. I'd like to quickly add any statement I make should end with the words, I can be wrong, and at least I'm thinking them, if not always saying them. But that said, I also think that as we look at the New Testament, there's parts that really ring true and hang together in terms of what you might call the teachings of Jesus that survive. And by the way, there's a historical verbal tradition, an oral tradition, which also bears witness to this, so it isn't only the Bible. And you don't find the harsh damnation stuff in there. That's sort of a later part that's been added in the New Testament to bolster the authority figures in the church. But in the actual teachings of Jesus, that I happen to believe were taught by him, it's very, very clear that if an Ann Coulter showed up and said, you know, liberals are this or that, the first thing Jesus would say, and I'm not putting words in his mouth, but taking it straight from Scripture, is that, you know, if you judge, you will be judged, and that the guarantee of the loss of your soul, let's not even talk about eternity, but just the loss of your soul, and therefore the loss of salvation, whether it's about this life or the next, is to think that you are holy and righteous and other people are lost. And so, you know, we have the parable of the publican and the sinner, and the Pharisee and the sinner, and the Pharisee is saying, oh, Lord, I thank you, I am not as other men. And the publican comes and says, I'm nothing, and I know I don't even deserve to be standing here in the temple. And Jesus says, who goes up sanctified after that? Well, it's not the Ann Coulters of this world or the Bill O'Reillys or even me holding forth right here on this radio station, to be honest. If Jesus' teaching is correct, it's people who are humble enough to see that they cannot stand in judgment of others and just write them off, but that they are in the same boat, and that, you know, as the Orthodox Holy Fathers of the Desert put it, who were a long way from Bill O'Reilly, the only salvation that you're responsibility to work on is your own. And so this moralistic judgment of other people in American politics today and by the religious right, it's so far away from the teaching of Christ as he exists in the New Testament and the oral tradition of the church without the overlay that comes in the epistles and so forth, which is a different matter, but that the actual words and parables we have, that you literally could not get more further away. And so what's ironic is that the Christian right in America, in terms of espousing the actual values found in the New Testament, in the words of Christ himself, if those are to be taken seriously, which they say they are taking seriously, could not actually be further away from the spirit of those words if they tried. And I'm not being hyperbolic here. I'm literally saying that. You could not put together a system of thought further away from the spirit of forgiveness, charity, and humility that you find in the teachings of Christ. Judge people, there goes your salvation out the window. And so, you know, we have to understand that if you're going to take the teachings of Christ seriously, then the least Christian, in the true sense of the word, group that you could find in America today are, you know, not gay people getting married, not AIDS victims, not teenage prostitutes on a corner, you know, down on Beverly Wilshire somewhere. It is Christian pastors in pulpits, Ann Coulter, Bill O'Reilly, the Fox News team, who stand in moralistic judgment. I didn't say you can't disagree with anybody, but moralistic judgment. In other words, you are a sinner and wicked and I am saved. According to Christ, even to make such a judgment shows that you're so far from the kingdom of heaven. So, you know, the moralizing that goes on it's been amazing. And, of course, I think one of the results of that is this kind of gross departure from the teaching of Christ is the hypocrisy that goes with it. And one passage I have in Sex, Mom, and God says, listen, you know, if you find a moralistic crusader in the religious right, you can assume that he or she is hiding something. It's, you know, the gay bashing activist turns out to be gay and was in the closet trying to hide it. The moralistic family values pusher in Congress is on C Street, you know, getting ready to go off with his mistress to South America. It's inevitable. The Roman Catholic priests and bishops who have been telling all of the women in America that they can't use birth control, that abortion is murder, that stem cell research is wrong, that gay people shouldn't be married, have been running the world's biggest pedophile network, you know, with impunity for the last 50 years. So when you really look at the whole picture, not only is it so far away from the teaching of Christ to moralistically grandstand against individuals, the result has been a level of hypocrisy which has completely undermined the credibility of religious institutions, because the very people doing it have been found to not only not been practicing what they preach, but leading the charge on the very sort of decadence they're theoretically denying.
I appreciate, Frank, the good work that you've done here. And let us not forget that Bill Riley also is the master of condemning anyone for anything that he perceives is not living up to his form of moralizing, biblical moralizing. And yet, was it not he and Fox Network that settled a substantial sexual harassment suit? And wonder how long he's going to take redeeming his own fear by being the ultimate crusader against other people's sexual needs. Just
right.
Stupid to the end. Thank you very much, Frank Schaefer, and the book, for those who would like to read it, I definitely suggest it. It's a real eye-opener. By the way, do you have a website people can go to also?
Sure. It's just my name, frankschaefer.com, RF, you know, Frank, and then FCHAEFFER.com. And I always answer my email, so if they just hit contact, I do read them and I do answer them, and the book is available, Sex, Mom, and God is available, you know, on all the usual places.
All the best to you, Frank.
Thanks so much.
I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you all for listening. Hope that we've shared some insights and that gives us a little better perspective. Have a nice day.